darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision.
Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
I'm Mark Herney, and I'm here with Aaron West. Aaron, I have one word for you, and I'm sure you know what it is.
Let's say it together. Plastics.
I added a syllable there. I was gonna do something else, but it would kind of give away the ending, like yell your name, Aaron. But anyway,
okay.
Well, moving on. Episode 33. Folks have seen the movie; they know we're talking about The Graduate. With Mike Nichols today, but before we get into that, we have to welcome, we have a first-time guest, but not a first-time talker, as far as I'm concerned. I've guested on your show so many times, Tim. It's been awesome to do that, and I'm very excited to have you on, finally, on Criterion Close-Up. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Mark.
You didn't say who it was.
Oh, Mr. Tim Costa from First Time Watchers. My goodness.
Hi, Mark. You got Mark to watch The Room, so that you're gold in my book.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored. I feel a little out of my league right now. A little like I'm almost drowning, if you will.
Oh, nah.
In that wetsuit, huh?
Yes, indeed.
There is no league, Tim.
Okay, if you say so. But seriously, you know, if there were leagues, I think yours would be the major leagues. Well, we're on our show kind of floundering in single A, maybe getting up to double A every once in a while.
Nice. Well, hey, you guys did Rafifi recently, or a few weeks back. So
We did, yeah. After hearing you praise it a little bit earlier, I think, and
nice.
And yeah, it certainly interested us.
Well, I got to say, happy 200th episode. That is awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
For those that don't know, Tim is from First Time Watchers podcast, which Mark has a segment, Criterion 101. So is this like Criterion 102?
Yeah, I think so.
This is the graduated course right here. Yeah, for everybody
literally.
Needs to take the master's course. Yeah.
We're talking about The Graduate, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, that's what you called him the right before he started the show, right? You said he graduated. So.
He certainly did. He certainly did. Yep, and he found a great partner in you, Aaron.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I really enjoyed hearing the words. In fact, I almost cried during your 200th episode and all the gushing. And it was almost to the J.D. Brennan level, but not quite.
Well, you know, all the credit does belong to Brendan, yes. But when it comes to your show, every word that I said during that segment was absolutely true. So I'm very proud of you. It's like it's like one of my own. Has gone on to
that's right.
College, you know.
Yeah.
So proud.
Well, not yet. We're not to 40 episodes yet.
Right.
By then we're
getting close.
We're getting close,
yeah. Tier. Yeah, I actually just came across that today, so the symmetry was very nice. Nice words. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, no
You're
problem.
Very kind. Yeah, it's been, you know, folks can tell, I've known Tim for a while. He's a great guy, does a great job on First Time Watchers, of course, with Tim, with Hermano and Walter, too. So really good show, and we'll get their link a little bit later. Folks definitely want to check them out there. A lot of fun to listen to, and very knowledgeable, although Tim says mm-hmm. otherwise
they are.
Sometimes. So.
They are.
Yeah.
You're too kind.
Yes, very cool. So as we already mentioned, we are going to be talking about Mike Nichols, The Graduate from 1967. But before we get into that, there's a line from First Time Watchers. We've got to kick it back to Tim. Tim, we want to know about your Criterion connection. How did you first become aware of, or what was your first Criterion release?
I learned it from watching you. Okay, I learned it from watching you. In all seriousness, Mark, it was really you, I think, when we brought you onto the show after our 100th episode, because that's when you first joined us.
Yep.
You know, the several times afterwards that you were on our show, you started, you know, discussing all these Criterion films, and that's mm-hmm. you know, in hearing you guest on some other shows as well, you would discuss the Criterion Collection, and that's really when it opened my eyes as to what that was. So I was really a newbie. I honestly didn't even realize I owned two Criterion DVDs until, like, after you had started joining the show, and I started paying attention to what my spines actually said and looked like. and the two Criterions I owned were RoboCop and Armageddon, unbeknownst to me, you know. So it was really you who helped open my eyes to that world, and then it made me appreciate, you know, that niche, if you will, you know. It's only been the last couple of years that I've really, become aware of it. And so, honestly, I'm your least qualified candidate to ever have on the show in more ways than one.
Well, it's funny is when you tweet us and say, "Oh, I got a Criterion," we play the guessing game. And I know, remember, one was the 400 Blows. I think the other was Rififi, and I think there were some others too. So.
We'll get into that, I think, a little bit later. But yes, it's just happenstance when Netflix sends me a Criterion DVD, you know, and then I'm like, oh, I should tweet you guys.
We like to see that, of course. And, you know, you mentioned that you had sent me off, graduated to college, but, you know, they call Criterion Film School in a box. So, you know, I've helped you graduate to Criterion.
After this extensive research, in this schooling in this box that we're going to be talking about, I can definitely see where you're coming from.
Nice.
Yeah, glad this one is delve into it. It's pretty full.
Yeah, it's more, well, we'll get into it, more stacked than a lot of them, but yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It's quite the disc.
Okay. Yes.
So, yeah. And so we just have a couple other things we wanted to mention when we'll get into some short takes, but we wanted to mention, if folks haven't checked it out yet, we had an inaugural episode on Criterion Cast called Criterion Cast Chronicles that Aaron had the pleasure of joining. He was joined by Ryan, David, and Scott talking about the February Criterion releases. And first episode, number one, kind of a episode where instead of talking about what is coming, they've talked about what was just released. So the month in review. And it was great, Aaron. It was really fun to listen to. Great to hear your takes on it. And it gave us a little insight into your thoughts on The Graduate, too.
Well, we'll see about that. I think I said The Graduate was the one I was least looking forward to. So, we'll see if that changed. True. It was really the brainchild of Ryan Gallagher, and you know, we kind of all put our heads together, and he has a great panel there, yourself included, and I hopefully you can make the next one. I think that's happening.
I think that's in the plan.
So it's a great series, we have our close up, which is kind of a nice supplement too, because those are more short takes, and of course we talked about The Graduate, but now we're going more in depth on The Graduate, and I'm sure that'll be a recurring theme as we grow there and grow here.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to listen to. So again, recommend folks check out CriterionCast.com, check out Chronicles. Of course, you can find us there too. Other great shows, so you should be listening on a regular basis. Lots of good content.
Go to the Criterion Master feed, and I think there's going to be a feed for Chronicles. There might already be. I didn't check before the show, but if not, it's just easier to get everything at the Master feed.
Yep, definitely. So I wanted to mention a couple of feedback items from our Gross Out episode. We had asked for some feedback, and we got some. One of the things that we'd asked about was really wanted to get a female perspective on Lars von Trier. Tim, I know you've seen a Lars von Trier film, haven't you?
I've seen a couple of them. One of them,
Nymphomaniac, I remember. Yeah.
Nymphomaniac is actually was in my top 10 of last year, as well as making my top 5 of the decade so far.
Wow. Oh, nice. Yes. Or 2014, right? Wasn't that Nymphomaniac, I think?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Whichever year it came out in, it was in my top 10.
It made the top 10.
Yes.
Nice. Well, we got some feedback because we were, you know, curious. Some have accused Lars von Trier of being misogynistic. And, curious, we had four guys on the show, and differing opinions. And so we wanted to get a female perspective. And luckily, we got Leanne Kubitz from LMK Films. We'll actually link to her Nymphomaniac review in the show notes. She sent in some feedback, so I just wanted to read briefly. Firstly, she gave us some yay us feedback, so thank you, Leanne. We appreciate that. Always.
Thank you, yes.
She said, you know, she's a huge admirer of Lars von Trier. I actually do believe he's the best director in the world, or close to it. It was very interesting hearing your thoughts on the misogyny or perceived misogyny of his work. Many male critics feel that way, yet I feel the opposite. I see von Trier's work as being completely truthful of what it's like to live as a woman. I don't know how he totally gets it, as he's a man, but he really nails it. Life is that difficult when you're a woman. Every single von Trier woman feels real to me, and I see myself in them. I'm not reading all the notes, but a couple things here from Leanne. Again, she says, the hopelessness of doing everything right, putting out a brave face for others, working for a sociopath just to make a bit of money, pervasive sexism, are experiences which most women deal with daily and internalize. I feel a sort of catharsis from his work. He's showing the truth of womanhood, and it is not a joyful position. It is demoralizing and may leave you broken. So, and she mentioned a bit about Nymphomaniac about the end there. I'm just going to leave it there. Yeah, some great feedback, Leanne. Yeah, really appreciate that.
By the way, he would agree that he is the greatest filmmaker ever. So, Liam, you have that in common. I actually have some feedback, some similar feedback. Remember how I wondered how Kristen would respond, or how she would judge whether von Trier is a misogynist? Well, I just asked her, and she said no. So there you go. He's not a misogynist.
Wow. And I think, Aaron, you had some feedback on The Devils from someone else.
I did, from my friend Alan, who is one of the smartest film guys I know, and he really enjoyed our discussion, and he had some comments about, you know, the religion and politics, and he said the biggest problem is that it's perceived as being about religion and politics and intolerance, and of course it's about that. Russell and Reed in particular were inspired by the troubles in Northern Ireland, but at its heart, what people don't get is that it is a black satire. And that is why Russell and Redgrave were laughing. At its absolute bedrock, it's not about religion or politics, but about the marketing and creation of hysteria and how people can be manipulated by hysteria into doing the exact opposite of what is best for them. And he goes on about more plot details. You know, he wrote a pretty long thing, but you know, I can see that too. Of course, you didn't get to see The Devils. And Tim, I doubt you've seen it.
I have not.
See it. It's good.
Yeah, it's one I really wanted to catch up with. So, and I know it was high on Cole's list. I think he listed it number one of all the ones that we reviewed. So, high praise from Cole and you, Aaron.
Good stuff, and I would love to see a Criterion release.
Yeah, nice. So let's get into some short takes. We're going to do one film. This is where we talk briefly about something that we've seen recently, similar to your yay or nay segment, Tim. You know, it was one of those things. We do watch some other movies, and we felt it was it's a fun way to just give a short take and, you know, see what share some thoughts. Maybe people want to check it out, maybe not. So I'll turn it to you, Tim. What did you watch recently?
Well, I could give you, if we're going to be discussing one film, I could give you a choice between two. One is a Criterion film that's highly regarded. And the other one is a certain Netflix series where I watched the pilot, and it's called Fuller House.
Yeah, let's go with the Criterion one.
Are you sure? You're 100% positive.
Yeah, I've already got the Fuller House take from my daughter, and it's thumbs down. So yeah, let's hear your Criterion take.
Well, it's a certain Bergman film that... I think I teased you guys about. It's from 1957, and it's called The Seventh Seal.
Yes.
Yeah, playing chess.
So, as I'll probably prove later on this episode as well, that I'm completely out of my element when it comes to this film. So this is my very first Ingmar Bergman film. And I think, Mark, when you were on our show some weeks ago, you had suggested this be the introduction to Ingmar Bergman. And yep. uh, and I, I, I guess I can see why, because it has an interesting mix, I guess, of high art as well as interesting drama. But there's a lot in here that is just well above my head. I understand that it's allegories and metaphors up the wazoo, you know? I mean, just the synopsis itself has a lot of layers to it, where a man seeks answers about life, death, and the existence of God as he plays chess with the Grim Reaper during the Black Plague. I mean, there's a lot of layers there and a lot of things, just elements to dig into. Now, mind you, it's been a few weeks since I've seen this, so not everything is fresh in my mind, but I do remember seeing Max von Sydow and thinking, has he always looked old compared to his age? Because apparently he's in his 20s, I think, at this time, maybe around 30 years old, and he looked like he's well into his 40s at this point. like I said, there's so much to dig into that it's so hard. You know, honestly, Netflix sent me the Criterion disc, and it's not something I delve into because when it comes to Netflix discs, it's more, for me, it's just I would rather just watch it and then go on to the next movie, you know?
Yeah, so, sure. Send it back.
So I don't know how well I can actually talk about all the themes and the layers in this movie, but it's very deep, it is engrossing. It's not, I didn't find it boring at all. I just found it complicated, I think is
challenging,
a kind word.
Yeah.
Challenging is a good word, yes. Absolutely.
Well, what Mark didn't tell you is that it is the best entry point for Bergman, but the thing is you have to watch it 9 times.
Good point.
Yikes.
He was, you were right with von Sydow. He's 28 years old there. I was just looking it up, so.
And for what it's worth, I would actually recommend Wild Strawberries as the intro to Bergman, personally. Okay. I think I can see how, it's dense too, but in a different way, in a little more accessible way. But yeah, Seventh Seal is pretty heady.
Yeah. And you know, looking back on it, maybe something like Smiles of a Summer Night, because it's, you know, it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Might even be better, but I think...
Monica, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. But you've got to... I mean, if you're really going to get Bergman... you know, maybe start there and then move to The Seventh Seal. But
okay.
Yeah, if that's a great barometer to see if you're going to like Bergman or not.
If I go into Bergman again, it may be those that you recommend, but it'll probably be a little bit because it certainly seems like he is someone who likes to toy with deep thematic elements.
Yes.
So. Yes, that's an understatement. He's a very deep filmmaker.
Sure.
And in fact, somebody on Twitter asked us if we're going to cover Bergman at some point, and I think, yes, we couldn't have a Criterion podcast without it. So
yeah, I was going to say, I can't imagine you not covering him.
Yeah.
The question is how to do it right. So.
Sure.
Yep. So, Aaron, I'll turn it to you. What's your short take?
Well, mine is not on Criterion. I watched I think it was an Arrow release. I watched Cinema Paradiso, the 1988 Italian film. I'd seen it before. I'd seen the shorter version. There are two versions. There's one that's just a little over 2 hours, and then a director's cut, which is 3 hours. And we watched the director's cut. Have you guys seen it?
Yes.
I saw it a couple of years ago, and I believe I saw the director's cut, and I bawled my eyes out at the end.
Okay, well, I did not like the director's cut at all. The director's cut, well, I won't go into the ending, but the regular movie, the theatrical, is very, very moving, very impactful, and very emotional at the end. Whereas I think the director's cut, it adds about an hour to the end. And you see what actually happened, and I think it kind of loses the magic. So
okay, then I did not see the director's cut. Then because if you're talking about how emotional the ending is, I remember that very clearly. So I definitely saw the theatrical version.
Hmm.
Yeah, I might ask you off air. I don't want to spoil both cuts for our listeners that haven't seen it. But But yeah, I still liked it. It was kind of interesting. But if you haven't seen it before, I would recommend the shorter cut, which is it's still 2 hours. It moves very fast, and it has a beautiful score by Morricone, one of my favorite Morricone scores. It's not, you know, like the typical we think of, you know, the Tarantino ripoff or spaghetti western ones. But beautiful movie. A little bit on the sentimental side, but you know, I forgive it. Of course, it goes through film history. Has a big scene from Il Greedo in it, so that that gets me going. So anyway, that's my short take. And
nice. That's kind of a favorite of mine. I picked up that Arrow disc too. I just love the movies about movies. Sort of.
Yes, sir.
With that one. So my short take is a new film. Folks might have heard of it just because it won the Oscar this year in Spotlight.
Nice.
2015, director Tom McCarthy. Aaron, I know you've seen this. Have you seen this, Tim?
I have, and it was also my co-host Wally's favorite movie of the year.
Nice. Wow. That's right. Did it make your list? I couldn't remember.
No, I think it was around number 14 on my top 20.
Okay, so this one is it's the true story of how the Boston Globe uncovered the massive scandal of child molestation and cover-up within the local Catholic archdiocese, shaking the entire Catholic Church to its core. This one won a couple of Oscars. It won Best Picture, of course, which in retrospect really is not a surprise. And it also won Best Original Screenplay for Josh Singer and Tom McCarthy. So Best Writing, Best Original Screenplay. Stars Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Rachel McAdams, Liv Schreiber, and John Slattery of Mad Men fame. So this film, I thought this film moved rather quickly, kind of surprisingly for me, for such a, you know, dialogue-driven film. And of course, it's such a compelling investigation. And, you know, I know this film has been really compared to, of course, All the President's Men, because it shows how news is delved into and considered, and the investigation and how long it takes, and, you know, knocking on doors and, you know, all those pieces. So, I thought it moved along really well. I felt a little shell-shocked after the film, which I think is a good thing in that it certainly affected me. I even noticed in the credits that there was an allegation for me locally here in Vermont, right next door, and so that's kind of that's like a gut punch, similar.
Yeah,
to the film.
You talk about the gut punch. It definitely continues throughout the credits when there's just a long list. Let's just say.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough, and I know this all took place not too far from you, Tim. So.
About 30 miles north. Yep.
Yep. So, and this, you know, I would like to see, actually would like to see a documentary style about this story, because I think you could see both sides of it. And, you know, the only other side you kind of see with this is with the one priest. But on the other hand, I think it's almost perfect that the only view that you get is to really with that priest, where, you know, he says, well, but I didn't enjoy it, you know. So he's really there's that theme of, you know, justifying their actions in this film. So
yeah, I wonder how a documentary would really be any different, other than more factual evidence and instances, more different than the movie itself. You know, I wonder how much more ground it could cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd probably be more interviews with the people involved, and you know, of course, less fictionalized.
Right.
I liked it too. I would say I haven't seen all the Best Picture nominations this year, but I'm not disappointed with it winning. I would pick, probably of the ones I've seen, I'd pick Mad Max. But
yes.
Actually, did you watch it with a wife?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She.
Yeah, my wife loved it.
Oh, really?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yours?
Yeah, I think she was there. She felt she seemed kind of shell shocked like I did after. So yeah, we both liked it a lot.
Yeah, it's a moving movie.
Well done film. Yeah, really, really great ending. The ending is perfect. Mm-hmm. I think so.
All right, now we're gonna cry as we go to plastics and seducing.
Cinema Paradiso Spotlight. So cool. Well, and I should mention, I did want to include just a link to my, I finally posted my top 10 films of 2015, and Aaron mentioned Mad Max, which I'll just spoil and say that was my number one. So we'll include a link to that. Folks want to check that out. There's a few other art house movies that hopefully folks have seen. And if you haven't, just some recommendations of mine. So.
Oh, and you might be also be able to hear it on a certain show. That
yes.
Others might be able to listen to.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Tim. Yeah. I joined part two of the best of 2015 on First Time Watchers, and I actually got to list the other five too. But yeah, that was a fun discussion. Thanks again for having me.
It was.
So, did Spotlight make the list?
Well, I hadn't seen it then, so I haven't changed my list after seeing Spotlight.
Okay.
Yeah. Just kind of kept it where it was.
I'm thinking probably, it's hard to say because I still have a lot to see, but I'm thinking probably I'm with Tim, you know, maybe in the teens. Good movie, but maybe not the best of the year.
Yeah, yeah, it'd probably be close for me, maybe number 10. But. Yeah. So, well, we're going to take a quick break. We had The Sound of Silence lead us in, and we're going to, of course, transition with Mrs. Robinson before we get into The Graduate. So we'll take a break and come right back.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
Welcome back, everyone, to Criterion Close-Up. I'm Mark Herney, here with Aaron West and our special guest, Tim Costa, of the First Time Watchers podcast. We are here talking about The Graduate from director Mike Nichols. 1967 film. Writer Buck Henry and Calder Willingham, maybe. The novel is by Charles Webb. The actors, Dustin Hoffman plays Benjamin Braddock, Anne Bancroft plays Mrs. Robinson, Catherine Ross, Elaine Robinson, and we have Murray Hamilton as Mayor Vaughn. Oops, sorry, jaws in the brain. Mr. Robinson, and William Daniels, Elizabeth Wilson as Mr. and Mrs. Braddock. This is a very well-known film, Spine Number 800 for the Criterion Collection. Award-wise, I mean, it won Best Director Oscar for Mike Nichols, and it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor for Hoffman, Actress for Bancroft, Supporting Actress for Ross, the first three I mentioned. Also, a screenplay for another medium, Willingham and Henry, and cinematography, Robert Surtees. So those are some topics we'll get into in a little bit. Of course, this is a film, really one of the most beloved films of all time. Brought Simon Garfunkel music to a wider audience and introduced us to Dustin Hoffman. And the character Benjamin Braddock is, he just finished college. He's already lost in a sea of confusion, barely contain angst when he becomes sexually involved with a friend of his parents, the indomitable Mrs. Robinson, before turning his attention to her college-age daughter. So, yeah, this is quite the film. Spine Number 800, again, this is a big deal for Criterion to be releasing something like this type of film and, having a... You know, the 100 spine numbers, they typically go out with a really special release. So important that this is here. And we kind of wanted to set things up a bit with the 1967 film scene. There's a really great book that I know Aaron has read. I listened to the audiobook, very great audiobook called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. So we thought that's a good way to kind of set this up before we go into the film, because it was nominated for Best Picture, and as I mentioned, did not win. But Aaron, I'll turn it to you. Stop talking for a minute and, give us a sense of, this scene, the 1967 film scene. It's talked about quite a bit, and let's set it up for listeners.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that book is, I would highly recommend Pictures at a Revolution by Mark Harris. And it pretty much sums up, well, it's really about the five Best Picture nominees from that year. And as you noted, The Graduate was one of them. It lost to In the Heat of the Night. There was another one, was Bonnie and Clyde. There was also Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And the other one was Dr. Doolittle, which doesn't, it's kind of the outlier. But it was really more about the transition from old Hollywood to new Hollywood. You know, we talked about the studio system a couple weeks ago. Did we? Yeah, I think we did. I forget. We talked about the code a couple weeks ago. Anyway.
Yeah, we did get into the code. Yep.
So, but this was, of course, this was the end of the Hays Code, and one connection with the last the Grossette episode is we did mention that the code was more lenient with War as Hell movies, and one of those was The Pawnbroker, and so they allowed a snippet of nudity to show through because it was showing the torture of war. Mm-hmm. And The Graduate actually piggybacked on that, and that's how we got that that little nude frame of Bancroft. Anyway,
the Flash.
I'm getting ahead of myself here. So it's about those five movies, and if you think about it, really two of them are I wouldn't say establishment Hollywood because they both had Poitier. You know, one was a kind of a civil rights sort of picture. The other was a detective. The winning picture was more of an old school detective movie, and even though it had Poitier, it was you know, he intentionally did not want to play a race relations role. He wanted to actually play just have African American play a regular character, in this case a detective, Mr. Tibbs. And then The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde were something completely new. They were subversive. They broke through the norms of that the studios were producing. They introduced a lot of sensuality to film. You know, actually, Warren Beatty may be more of a prototypical star, but Dustin Hoffman is not. Mm. And of course, Warren Beatty in Bonnie and Clyde was portrayed as being impotent, and that's not exactly a leading man kind of character. But then, on the other hand, you had Dr. Doolittle, which I think is basically remembered as being, you know, maybe okay at best. You know, some might say a heaping pile. I'm not a fan of Dr. Doolittle, but it's really not my type of movie. And that just shows that, you know, the Academy doesn't always get it right. And sometimes it'll just reward a film just for, you know, making money or that sort of thing. That probably hasn't changed too much. Anyway, they were all influenced by the French New Wave, Italian neorealism. In fact, you know, Mike Nichols talks about Blow Up and Persona in his commentary. So these were very much a product of these other film movements. And in fact, Francois Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard were actually attached to Bonnie and Clyde at one point. However, Mike Nichols was always going to do The Graduate after Virginia Woolf. So anyway, that was probably longer than you wanted, but it does sum up the year. It was a big year for American film, and it pretty much ushered in what we think of as the American New Wave, which would lead to some really good American work in the 70s.
Perfect. Yeah, I love it. Nice work, Aaron.
Thanks.
You do a great job with those setups. It's been a few years, probably 3 years since I listened to it, and yeah, it was a great synopsis. I did want to mention just a couple things. You'll have to forgive me for bringing up the Howard Suber commentary early. But there are a couple things that are mentioned there that I think help with the setup with this the film scene and what's going on at the time, where we speak of it, in the commentary. Again, we'll talk about it later. He speaks about the beginning of the youth film movement with The Graduate. Will be, of course, more closely identified with Easy Rider a couple years later in 69. And the backdrop to this is there is, the 1964 Civil Rights Movement, which had moved to national attention in 1964, I should say. And then later that year, the free speech movement moved to Berkeley. And then in 67, we're getting students seizing campuses. So, of course, mm-hmm. part of this film takes place there. And we don't really see that. We kind of miss that. And there was also something, you know, I think this was mentioned about the sealing off of the old culture, and I was thinking about maybe, you know, the sealing off of the old film culture too, which we'll talk about later when we get into the ending. So I'll save that until we get into quote unquote spoilers. But that's the setup. That's the 1967 film scene, and we thought we'd, of course, get into some of the filmmaking style. We do have a couple of questions. Tim, I'm curious what you thought of the filmmaking as far as the acting. We'll kind of include acting and cinematography together. Anything on the direction, too. I mean, it's really, Nichols had won for, kind of considering maybe this should have won Best Picture. I think if I was going to vote, I would go this or Bonnie and Clyde, really, over the other films. But, he did win for directing, so, feel free to mention anything there. But, yeah, acting, cinematography, directing, any of the filmmaking pieces that really stood out to you, Tim?
Well, when you talk about the other films that were up for Best Picture, I've only seen Bonnie and Clyde out of the other four. So,
okay.
And this is actually the second time I've dug into this movie, because we actually reviewed this movie back in episode 156 sometime last year. On
that's
our
right.
show.
Yeah, that's cool. Right. I remember you mentioned that as one of your top five films that you guys reviewed, if I remember, on your 200th episode.
Yes, because it left a big impact with me. I think it's one of my favorite films that we've reviewed out of the 200 plus movies that we've talked about. And it's, I don't know, there's something that really connected with it to me. And when you talk about directing, I can definitely see that. You know, one of the interesting things, I think, as we'll get into it later in the show, is when I first got the disc, the first thing I did was I watched the movie with the commentary with Nichols and Soderbergh. And honestly, like I've alluded to earlier in the show, I'm the worst person to have on this kind of show, because I am not one to dig into special features. So me going into most of these special features is something unique to me. And when it comes to commentary tracks, I honestly don't think I've ever listened to a commentary track while watching a movie before.
Wow.
So it was something new to me. But one thing I appreciated while watching the commentary is you're not hearing the dialogue on screen. You're hearing two people talk over the film, and
right.
I'm able to see more aspects of the filmmaking a lot clearer, I think, without the distraction of trying to pay attention to the film itself.
Sure.
So I'm seeing a lot of interesting shots in placements. When it comes to the cinematography, I was really struck, especially, I think one of the most striking things, of course, is the beginning and the opening credits. Of course, that long take mm-hmm. of him mm-hmm. on the runway, which is essentially him moving against his will, him being pushed to forward, essentially. It's a symbolic moment. You have that moment where when he gets home and it's focused a close up on his face, and then his parents enter the room one by one, and it's still focused on his face, and his father is in the foreground. His father's face is in the foreground, obscured not focused, and then in his mother walks in, just completely blocking in the screen, and then it pans back. So it's something that really struck me when you talk about the new Hollywood. Well, I don't know much about it. I think that's one thing you can point to, me being an amateur essentially, can point to, is saying, oh, this is different than what I've seen in the previous 20, 30, 40 years, where earlier films will have a lot of staged blocking, where a mm-hmm. lot of earlier films will have edits, cutting back and forth between the faces of the two or three characters that are speaking. Whereas this is completely negating everything that's been established that you're so used to in old Hollywood, essentially, So seeing that and being able to focus on something like that is really very, very interesting. And when it comes to the acting, I find little to fault with the acting. I have little to fault with the film in general. I love it that much. I think it's a phenomenal film. It's really just going to be a lot of praise for me, on my end.
Nice.
When it comes to almost all aspects of this film. Maybe I'll have a little bit of nitpicking when it comes to the music, but we'll get there. So, I mean, what did you think? I don't know. How do you guys feel?
Aaron?
I think first off, I think we should say that Nichols was, he came from the stage, and he had done Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Have you guys seen that?
Yes. Big fan.
Very good acting vehicle. Yeah. So he learned through two professionals how to direct actors, and I think that he took it to the next step here. Of course, Bancroft was a major professional, and also stage, and so was Hoffman too, even though he wasn't as well known in film yet. Of course, Bancroft had done The Miracle Worker. But he really got great performances out of these two. And Catherine Ross, too, I think she's a little overpraised. I think she was playing kind of a variation of herself. You can disagree. It's fine.
I'm with you, Aaron, a little bit.
Breaking my heart.
I mean, she was a person, you know, I got it. I got why he was attracted to her. But I think the dynamic between Hoffman and Bancroft in really the first half of the film is just fantastic. And I think the best scenes are when those two are together. Of course, there's the famous Are You Trying to Seduce Me scene, which is great. You know, you see her lighten up a little bit. She smiles, which is one of the few times she smiles in the film. But then you later see her go stone cold. You know, she reveals in the first scene she's an alcoholic, and you kind of see the fallout from that, and you know, maybe the sadness of her life as she's really sowing her wild oats with this younger man later in the movie. And of course, that's what leads to. Well, I won't get into plot stuff, but so anyway, I think they were both tremendous. Another scene I think that really stands out with performance is the one in bed where they keep turning the lights on and off.
And it
was interesting. You mentioned the commentary with Soderbergh. I didn't realize that the night shot was just a still and they just played the audio. I thought that was really cool. So, yeah, no, I think the performances are all great. Even the supporting performances, the nasally dad, the nasal-sounding dad, and the over-exuberant mom, you know, that screams when her husband's or her son is going to get married. I think the direction was great. With the cinematography, although I think Nichols deserves a lot of credit for the shots, too, which we heard him talk about on the, you know, he liked the long shots or the long lenses. And he really got some great results with that. And then some odd angles. And he said that he would recommend that the cinematographer, and why am I forgetting the name? Sirtis, was it?
Surtees.
Surtees, thank you. And he'd say, oh, try it. And Surtees would knock out a wall and try it, and it would work. And so there are a lot of interesting, views. And I think that that helped, reveal the two fractured people, you know, the one that was in a loveless marriage and the one who was lost and didn't know what he wanted to do with his life.
So I have to agree with you, Aaron. I think Hoffman and Bancroft are absolutely spectacular. I'm coming around a bit to Ross. She kind of comes and goes for me, but I would agree with you. I think this film is most interesting when they are on screen, and I think it does lose something, and it really, you know, the reason not quite the incredible film that I would normally say if it really kept up the back and forth cat and mouse kind of game that they're playing. And maybe it's more of a, you know, a cat and mouse. Well, yeah, cat and mouse is right, because she's a cougar, but she is so icy cold and powerful, and so seductive and engaging. I just think it's she's amazing, and he really shows nervousness just perfectly. I mean, when he you know, he puts his hand on her breast, and just that whole scene, the whole sequence through the hotel at the beginning is just lovely. And of course, you'll see the writer there at the beginning as a little cameo. So Buck Henry.
Buck Henry, yes, the hotel attendant. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
Where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I mean, I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
And she manipulates him too.
Yeah.
Pulls the strings, and he just goes right along with it. Like that little argument. Of course, she wins every time, except for the big deal.
Yep, exactly. Yep, and you can see it on her face. You know, he'll kind of cut away from her. But I think it's really, it's why we relate to Benjamin so much. I think partially because we see ourselves in him too. And rather than being like a perfect lead, originally I had seen that Robert Redford was supposed to be cast, and you know, they took a chance, and Hoffman absolutely delivered. And you know, the cinematography, I love, it's just some really great, I love the handheld shots at the beginning where everyone's pawing all over Ben, and you know, he couldn't give two craps about those people. And you know, you can feel for it. I've been in that situation. You just don't want to be there. He just captures it so well. And I really think you know, there's the cut scene from the pool to the, you know, the perfect cut of him jumping. And,
right.
Oh, that is easily one of the best shots I've ever seen. The best cuts I've ever seen. It's phenomenal. I remember the first time I saw this last year, I was struck. I was like in awe at that moment. I was like, what? How did they accomplish that? And then even seeing it the few times later, you know, especially with all the supplemental material, it still strikes me at how effective it is, you know, within that whole montage itself, you know. And also going back to the cinematography, you know, it's really amazing to see how it does strike a balance between a lot of handheld shots, a lot of a lot of first person perspective, and then also a lot of long takes. You know, they make a point of it, as we'll get to in the supplements when they talk about it, of a lot of key moments, they use long takes because it makes it more effective and more real, and you're more involved in that moment, you know, instead of those handhelds. And those handhelds, it totally works because you're in the mood with him of being suffocated or drowned or surrounded by those, all those elements that are pushing against him, you know? So that careful balance of going back and forth between, a handheld to long takes is really well done, well done.
And I like that they did not they were not stuck with long takes, and they would do a lot of quick cuts and sometimes really quick cuts, like the church scene, which we're going to get into in a bit. You know, there's a lot of like really jarring cuts of just, you know, a couple seconds of movement that just worked perfectly, and they kind of capture that energy, the chaotic energy. Whereas you know, like of course the intro party, you know, that's supposed to capture the awkwardness, and just seeing him roam around and being kind of lost in his own shell, you know, the filmmaking did add to that, I think.
Yeah, it feels like a subtle camera to me somehow, and you know, you could, maybe folks at the time would see it as flashy, but I just think it seems so effortless, the way it goes along, and you know, that camera that was in the building that goes up and down the pole to kind of capture them on the stairs. It's just, yeah, it's a really, it's again, it's a testament to, I think you both of you kind of alluded to it, people working at the top of their games, really, and really being able to work on this. They had months to really plan this, you know, and do the you know, rehearsals and blocking and whatnot. So,
however, I will point out two different zooms, a zoom out and a zoom in, that work in contrast with each other, that I think one is very effective and the other is not. The first one I'll talk about is the zoom out where the Catherine Ross character has that revelation with Hoffman and Bancroft, and he comes out of the room and she's down the hall. It's close up on her face, and it zooms out to his face, and then it fades out to the next scene. And I really like that scene. I think it's very effective.
I like that too.
But then there's the scene later on in the film where he's waiting at Berkeley at the fountain, and he stands up and the camera zooms in past and through the fountain and over to her coming down the stairs. And I find that very distracting. I don't like it that much. I think it's trying to do too much with the zoom lens, if you will. It just calls itself out to me a little bit, as opposed to all the other great camera movements throughout the rest of the film. So it's just two zooms that I think are in conflict with one another.
Yeah, I think they were playing around, so not everything was a home run. But I would say most of the time, at least in my opinion, I think they did a pretty good job with the camera. And I like the way they use close-ups. You know, of course, there's a very pivotal scene where You know, we see three characters, and we see when we see the mother, the daughter is blurry, and then she comes into focus, and her reaction changes. Yeah, so
it's a fantastic.
Yeah,
a lot of good
it's
shots.
It's probably my favorite shot in the film. It's just yeah, I love it. Rewatch that. So yeah, and it's you know, he's definitely, as far as Nichols go, he's an actor's director. You know, he's someone, and you'd really alluded to the you know, the stage, Aaron. He wanted input. You know, there's some directors, they just they want to not have input from the actors. They want to direct them, and he really wanted input from his actors. So yeah, nice. Seems like a guy who would be great to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into the music. We can't, of course, talk about this film without talking about it. 1967, really the first time, maybe?
Are we going to sing together, first, guys?
Which one do you want to do?
No, I'm kidding. You don't want that.
We could go on for a while. Yeah, and it's, you know, typically there were orchestra soundtracks up until this point, but, you know, a pop soundtrack was just not done. So this was pretty influencing. Mrs. Robinson, the song, was number one on the charts for 4 weeks. It swept the Grammys. It won Record of the Year, Best Pop Performance by a Vocal Group, Best Original Song for a score for motion picture. So really important. Curious what you guys, how did the music work for you, Tim?
For the most part, it works really well for me, with the exception of one song, and that is Scarborough Fair. Mm. I think, if anything, that is played two times too many, especially because it really comes in a lot towards the end of the film, and it seems to me like they ran out of music to use, or I couldn't choose or decide which music, because to me it doesn't really add anything to the mood of the film at that moment, especially when he's driving around, you know, so much. I don't really understand what it means so much. I mean, I totally get Mrs. Robinson. I totally get the Sounds of Silence, and a lot of the other songs, but for some reason that song is played too often for me, it just, I don't know, it just calls itself out for me again, you know. But other than that, I think everything is great. It's well done. It's perfectly executed.
You just really don't like spices, specifically parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme? Is that...
apparently I don't.
I got to disagree. I actually really like the Scarborough Fair sequences, and I think if you read the lyrics of the film, it does, you know, it is about kind of a lost love, or, you know, she once was a true love of mine, and I just like that. That's probably my favorite song of the major songs. I think the major three songs, even though I like Sound of Silence too. I think it's actually interesting seeing this, and seeing this as being groundbreaking, because it's so normal now, you know. And
sure,
sometimes now now, even since the 70s, 80s, people would develop a film around a soundtrack and just to sell albums, and that still happens to a degree.
Yeah, I think I did like the music a lot, and I really never noticed a false moment thinking about it, Tim, with your point. So that's a good sign. I did want to mention something that I thought of with the lyrics of The Sound of Silence, which of course closes and ends the movie, which we did start with. It's really about people not communicating and listening, and it just got me thinking about, of course, this political climate that we're in right now, where we have these kind of outside candidates that seem to be really keying into maybe people who feel like they're not being listened to, and aren't I don't know. It just seems like we're getting some strange candidates that seem to resonate with other people. So we've got,
The sound is definitely not silence, though.
No. Good point. So, yeah, I just, it made me kind of think about that. So it's just a strange kind of climate that we're in. You know, what's this, almost 40 years later?
Well, I think the times now are actually very similar to 1968, you know, only a year after this movie. So I agree with your sentiments.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
I'm just going to leave that there.
I'm going to leave it there too. And let the listeners piece together the rest.
Yeah, I don't want to get into politics, but so did want to, you know, we had a thought about the psychology of the relationship between the Robinsons and the Braddocks, and maybe this is really where we need to get into kind of what you were alluding to, Aaron. This is a different kind of lifestyle that these people lead, and you know, middle class at least. And so we wanted to talk about them and, you know, what it says about the period. So, you know, this is something I think you were thinking about, Aaron. Maybe I'll turn it to you first to talk about that.
Oof, boy, that's heavy. the psychology. Well, I think it does reflect, and I think just as we already kind of covered, the fact that Dustin Hoffman and this little kind of underspoken, not your prototypical Hollywood good looks, you know, the fact that he is the leading man and he's kind of an awkward ninny in a way, I think that speaks to, you know, people of the time could relate to that. You know, 1967, things were changing, and just the psychology of the world was changing. People could not identify with, well, even though he would become he would remain famous, Robert Redford, not so much, you know. In fact, there's a reason Hoffman became did have a career, and also Dreyfuss, who's in this movie. Richard Dreyfuss has a bit part. He's another guy that you could kind of put in the same, and Gene Hackman as well. A lot of actors that just everything changed. The psychology around the relationship, she is very, very tight-knit, and I think she almost, and she, of course she, even though the actress is only a few years older, she's supposed to be old enough to be his mother. And I think there's a generational issue there too. You know, the older generation is enticing, is attractive, but they can't really understand them. There's really nothing. There's no common ground. You know, they try to talk about art, but they and it turns out they both have somewhat of an interest at art at different stages of their life, but they really can never connect. And so I think that just maybe speaks to the different generations, and maybe that's a reach. I don't know. You tell me.
Mrs. Robinson, do you think we could say a few words to each other first this time?
I don't think we have much to say to each other.
Look, for months, all we've done is come up here and leap into bed together.
Are you tired of it?
I'm not, no. But do you think we could liven it up with a little conversation for a change?
Well, what do you want to talk about?
Anything. Anything at all.
Do you want to tell me about some of your college experiences?
Oh, my God.
How about art?
Art? That's a good subject. You started off.
You started off. I don't know anything about it.
Well, what do you want to know about it? Are you interested more in modern art or in classical art?
Neither.
You're not interested in art?
No.
Then why do you want to talk about it?
I don't.
Now, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation. Tell me what you did today.
I got up.
Oh.
I fixed breakfast for my husband.
There. There's something we could have a conversation about. Your husband.
Oh, him.
I mean everything. I don't know anything about how you work this. What do you say to him when you leave the house at night?
Nothing. He's asleep.
Always? Doesn't he wake up when you come home?
We have separate bedrooms.
Oh, I see. So you don't... I mean, I don't like to seem like I'm prying, but I guess you don't sleep together or anything.
No, we don't.
Well, how long has this been going on?
For God's sake, let's drop this.
Wait a minute. Why did you marry him?
See if you can guess.
Well, I can't. Oh, no, you had to marry him because you got pregnant.
Are you shocked?
Well, I never thought of you and Mr. Robinson as a kind of...
All right, now, let's get to bed.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. So how did it happen?
What?
You and Mr. Robinson. I mean, do you feel like telling me what were the circumstances? Was he a law student at the time?
Mm-hmm.
And you were a student also?
Mm-hmm.
At college?
Yes.
What was your major?
Art.
Art? But I thought you... I guess you kind of lost interest in it over the years, then.
Kind of.
certainly there with you. I did have a couple thoughts. Tim, any thoughts on the psychology of the relationships between the two families there?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't even think about it the way you had, Aaron. You know, but I don't know. I think it can be just tied into the baby boomer generation that this movie spoke to, you know, that this movie was even made by, essentially. Because, you know, Hoffman's character is literally a baby boomer, and he, this whole movie is about him trying to drive himself away from the expectations of his parents, of his parents' peers, you know. So he's trying to find any outlet, and it just so happens to come in this offer, essentially, by Mrs. Robinson, and it's even offered in what she says later on in the film about, you know, her relationship with her husband and what Benjamin gleans from that, you know, as to how they developed a relationship. So she is someone who was probably in a similar situation to him at her age, you know, when she was his age, but she had no recourse. She had no way out because that was just the time period, you know, the 20 years earlier, you know, so... and she's finally able, or willing to be able to, you know, come out of that shell, essentially, to detriment to herself, to her relationships, to anybody else around her, you know, and I also get the sense that this is not the first time that she's done this, you know, that she has probably done this in the past, and that's why she seems so skilled in luring the bait, if you will, when she first comes up to his room and then everything afterwards. So,
yeah.
So there is definitely a lot of layers there, but I think it just really comes down to essentially the outlook of the baby boomer generation, you know, and the need to get out of the rut, you know. So,
yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think thinking about their relationship, I mean, it's one thing I thought of, and I you don't really get a lot of insight into, as you guys were alluding to, Mrs. Robinson's, you know, her psyche. It's really just a one scene in the bedroom where he pushes her to talk. But I do think about, you know, the lives of these people who really don't want for anything. I mean, how do we really feel for them and about them? And she is kind of, at this point, trying to exert some control in her life as going for a younger man like this, and then also denying her daughter. And I know we had talked about control a bit in the Fat Girl episode. So it's I kind of thought of it a bit that way. And it's an interesting kind of dynamic, of course, between them as they are partners in, you know, some kind of a business that we're not really familiar with. So.
You know, and honestly, I think that this movie can really speak to a lot of millennials, you know, in this generation, where I think a lot of them are feeling the same way, where they're coming into their own at this same age as Benjamin is, that they don't know what to do, where to go, and honestly aren't finding much recourse, so and help in that either. So and they're just as lost as he is. So I think that this movie, there's a reason why it's so timeless, you know. Not just speaking to any generation after that, but I think specific generations too, you know. So I would not be surprised if this has a rebirth in appreciation.
Yeah, that's a great parallel. If you think about just the baby boom versus the millennials, the only thing is the millennials probably can't stand Simon and Garfunkel.
That could be.
They're listening to Adele or something.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll like Tim said, they'll come back to the movie and they'll come back to the music. We'll see. So should we get into the ending? We've got the church and the bus, and so if folks haven't seen The Graduate, you might want to just skip ahead just a few seconds, a couple minutes. We're going to talk about that. So I'll turn it back to you first, Tim. Of course, we all set it up. We get the church where Elaine is going to marry some other guy, really the Robert Redford character, although it's not played by him. And Ben is chasing after her, furiously driving after her, trying to find out where they went. He's pretty dubious in the way he does that. And he gets to the church right after they have been declared husband and wife, which is a bit of a change. The book actually had it happening before that. Just a little interesting switch. And of course, he's banging on the glass. She turned, calling Elaine, Elaine. And she turns around, and you know, there's a really, really great moment where she is considering walking towards him, looking at her parents and her fiance, husband, really, at that time, and just decides and yells after Ben. And then there's a kind of a chase, a fight ensues. There's the scene where Ben is swinging a cross, which is the part that I was alluding to before, where he actually swings the cross at them and then he sticks it in the door to kind of keep them locked in the church, where I was, you know, alluding to that as the, you know, the end of the really, you know, closing off the old generation, kind of similarly to doing that with in film, so to speak, the old Hollywood. And then we get to they ride off on the bus. And there's the, of course, the iconic long shot where they're kind of considering that. And I'll let you guys talk about that. I think it's just a great moment.
Real quick, just about the cross. What was kind of funny is that in the one commentary with Soderbergh and
Nichols.
Thanks. In that commentary, they said that that a lot of people had read into that cross as meaning something, but they actually just saw it as a utility you'd find it at a church that you could swing at people and bar great. A door. So they, anyway, that I thought that was funny.
That's good.
Yeah, it is a good moment. Mark, you talk about that moment as closing off the old Hollywood. I think that's perfectly tied into the other end moment of a movie in the same year in Bonnie and Clyde, where the two of them are being riddled with bullets, and those two, I think, are perfect endings to that old Hollywood. You know, one in closing off, you know, the old people, as you said, and the other one as, you know, bursting you into a glorious revolution of violence. You know, in mm-hmm. film, so I think those two can be tied in very closely together, but. The ending of The Graduate, I love it. I think it's phenomenal. You know, from the moment that he's running to mm-hmm.
Sprinting.
with that long lens that they mentioned that they had to use specially, and into the whole church scene is great. It's well edited. It's phenomenal. You know, obviously, if going into this movie fresh, brand new, not knowing anything about it, I didn't know that. They changed the ending from the book. So, you know, knowing that afterwards, it's an interesting note, but I don't think it really changes my opinion of the ending at all, because I think it works with everything else that's delivered throughout the rest of the film. I think it's both of them considering their lives, considering what has befallen them to this moment, and then realizing, F it. We need to do what is against everybody else's wishes, even if it isn't for the betterment of us. You know, not knowing mm-hmm. what's in the future, because they obviously don't know what's in the future, especially by that moment at the end on the bus. You know, where the looks on their faces, wavering between smiling and laughing and moments of reflection and concern for the future and going back and forth between them, I think it is a wonderful, wonderful touch, especially within the context of, like I said, the baby boomer generation, you know, moving forward with their own lives.
Yeah, the last minute or two that you referenced, I love that, because, of course, realistically, this is a doomed relationship, I think. You know, they just run out of a wedding. You know, he'd had an affair with her mother, and, you know, the parents hate him, and it's probably going to cause problems in his family. If you really put two and two together, it's probably not going to work out. But of course,
really, you come away with that? You don't think that the relationship works out?
I mean, maybe it could. They definitely want it. They definitely do. I mean, they're running away together. That's the impulse, and they're acting on it.
Right,
and,
but it definitely leaves it open to the viewer, you know. And that's one thing I've said on my show regularly is that I like moments in the end of films that leave a little bit of ambiguity to the viewer, and I think that this totally leaves it up to you. And to me, I think that there is definitely a chance, if not just out of pure stubbornness, that they stay together. Aaron, you feel differently?
Well, I really didn't want me to speculate too much about where they're going. Just that it's a complex situation, and so they're jubilant, and we see their laughter. But then, you know, as you mentioned, in the next moment, they're reflective, and I'm sure they're kind of thinking, "Oh, what have I done?" You know, we've just, and she's married, so they were too late. So you think, are they going to get it annulled? Are they going to, you know, how's that going to play out? I'll be a romantic and think that they will end up together, but it's going to be a challenge, you know, and of course life is not easy and it's not going to be easy. And I think that's part of the point of the film. It's, you know, you can't just get what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a piece too. It's interesting in the supplements, they kind of go back and forth as to how the ending happened. And, you know, they would only talk about that if, you know, because it is so popular. I think it is seen as a really great ending. And the piece that I think is neat is it seems like it may have been the editor Sam Osteen, who was there on the bus as the second director, or, you know, another director, and he was there and he forgot to yell cut. So they just kind of keep the camera rolling on the two characters, and you see that range of emotion for him. And of course, I think Nichols says that, you know, it was him, but who knows? I guess it doesn't really matter. I kind of like the Osteen, you know, piece of it, that maybe they were just kind of staying in character and not really completely, you know, within an acting. But and the thing that you know, really struck me too is you really get that really range of emotions from them. So, you know, they're laughing, you really get that elation, and then to that really, what do we do now kind of emotion on them. And I thought of it today where it's really what it feels like when you, even before your child is born, but on the day that your child is born, you'll have that same kind of feeling where, you know, you have that, of course, that incredible elation, especially when I think, you know, when your first child is born, but then it's like this, you know, huge responsibility will come over you, whether it's that day or later. Like, you know, I have this child to take care of, you know, for the rest of my life, and it's a big responsibility. And I think you kind of see that, you know, a similar kind of range of emotions with them, from elation to, you know, what do we do now? So,
yeah,
great ending. So why don't we, you know, we've talked about that, and really the last question I wanted to kind of ask, and maybe this can kind of lead into your film rating, is, you know, it's considered one of the all-time great American films. Didn't win Best Picture. It was nominated, won for Best Director. It is a comedy, and, you know, why is this such a important film? I mean, Criterion made it their spine number 800. I mentioned it's a big spine number for them. It's a very well-beloved film. So what makes it so great? Tim, what do you think?
And, well, I mean,
you can lead into your film rating, too.
Yeah, I mean, like I alluded to, and I've said previously, you know, I think it speaks to a specific generation so clearly with such force, you know, and with believable performances for me, you know, believable elements, just moments that resonate, you know, in would I do this, would I do that, you know, and what if I could do that, you know, what he's doing. I just think it's one of those seminal films, you know, that comes out at a specific time that is, it may be like a once in a generation film, you know, that speaks to so many people on such a visceral level. And maybe not once in a generation, you know, probably every 10 years you get a film like that, you know? So, that propels not just an audience forward, but the medium itself. I think that there's so many elements in this film that come together so fluidly that is so propulsive, you know. So, it's just so hard to not heap praise on this film, you know, because it means so much.
I think you like this film.
I adore this film. I love it. You know, nice. it's one of the things I had feared going into this dissection of this Criterion was that I would like it a little bit less or become a little bit tired of it with all of the examination, you know. And it wasn't the case, you know, I was just surprised at how well I still hold it in such a high regard, you know, and I think that shows its lasting endurance, you know. If it comes to a film rating, you guys do a number scale 1 through 10.
Yep, 1 to 10.
I would give it a 9.5 out of 10. Nice. I think it's that good, that worthy of such a high rating. The only thing that keeps it from being a perfect 10 is something I said before, is the repeated song of Scarborough Fair. I think it's just a lost moment when it comes to musical choice. But it's obviously it doesn't ruin the film in any way for me at all. So it's that good.
Cool.
Tim just doesn't like fairs. Oh, well.
He's not
no,
fair.
No, 9.5. It's good. So, Aaron, what do you think? Why is it one of the greats?
You know, I don't think I can answer better than Tim just did. And I think just the way it spoke to him really does answer the question. I think it's watchable. I think it's funny. I think it's awkward. And I think it has characters we like, even Mrs. Robinson to a degree. And definitely Elaine and Benjamin. So, yeah, I think it's funny. It's timeless. It's relatable. A lot of reasons why this has resonated, and also it was an important film. It was a big film, yeah. As we mentioned, Pictures at a Revolution. You know, it did pave the way for some more films going forward. So, as for film rating, I do like a lot of it, and which I've already kind of said. I do have some quibbles about the middle part. I think when he goes up to Berkeley and the stuff with the landlord Norman Fell, pre-Three's Company, wasn't as effective. In fact, I think, actually, even though I like the song Scarborough Fair and how they use it in the movie, I thought it was a little too montage heavy. So I don't. It for me, it didn't hold up to scrutiny as much as it did for you, Tim. But I still like it, and I like the first 45 minutes. I think are almost gold. I could watch those. You know, really, the courting and really just the rapport between Hoffman and Bancroft. So I'm going to say a 7.5. So that probably is right about my original rating, I think. But that to me, that's a good film.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was a little concerned when you were talking on Chronicles, but I thought, well, maybe if Aaron delves into the supplements, it might change. But well, it sounds like you're about there.
Just to speak to that, what I said was it was my least favorite of those that are coming out in March, and that's still the case. March is a great month for Criterion. So, but that doesn't really, you know, it's like five golden eggs and one just doesn't have as much luster as the others. So that's a terrible analogy, but yeah, there you go. What about you, Mark?
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah, I do. I like it quite a bit. I think it certainly resonates as an American film. We've talked about it quite a bit. I do think it does take some risks. I mean, Americans are seen as people that take some risks sometimes, and you know, sometimes it works out. We're innovative people, so this certainly is an innovative movie. It's a smart comedy, very much. It is a comedy, although sometimes maybe it doesn't seem like it. But I laugh out loud every time I see it. Certain scenes, mm-hmm. It captures suburban wife. It has all of the influences there from some of the, you know, great filmmakers that we like you know, your Antonionis and your Fellinis. Love to see that. I did like there's really I was thinking about the ending too, where Elaine looks at her mother and father and Carl, and she just doesn't want any of that. And that, you know, she decides to go with Ben. I just think of that as, you know, she knows what she's going to get with them. Ben is the excitement, kind of the unknown future. And that's, you know, that can be seen as something that's American, just, you know, jumping into it and, you know, just going for it. So, yeah, I think it's a great American film. I'm probably just a touch below Tim. I'm with you, Aaron, that I think it really the beginning part, as soon as we lose Mrs. Robinson, it's just not quite as interesting. Although I did like the date scene where you know, Ben takes Elaine out. I thought that was well done.
Oh, I know what you liked about that.
you're missing a great talent here. So no, but I'd give the film a 9. I could go as high as a 9.5, but I think it does kind of lose it a little bit there. It's interesting they did talk about the structure in some of the supplements, whether it's, you know, is it a 3-act? Is it missing a middle act? You know, is it only 2 acts? So it doesn't quite have the structure doesn't quite nail it. So it's a 9, but hey, we've been talking about the supplements. So, you know, let's talk about it. I'm going to say, you know, it with Criterion, it's hard to, not appreciate a film with, looking at the supplements. They are so persuasive. So, you know, I was interested to see how that kind of colored, our thoughts, but, there's a lot, so I'll be brief. Buck Henry and Lawrence Terman, the screenwriter and producer, respectively. That's a new conversation with them. And catch me if I miss one. There's a new interview from 2015 with Dustin Hoffman. There's also Sam and Mike. That's Sam Osteen, the legendary editor I mentioned before, who had also done Virginia Woolf, Cool Hand Luke, Rosemary's Baby, and Chinatown. His wife. Her widow, really. She is a writer, historian, editor in her own right. She talks about her late husband and working with Nichols. There's Students of the Graduate. This is a documentary from 2007. Features a lot of filmmakers, critics, and historians. The Graduate at 25, this goes back to 92, talks to Hoffman, Catherine Ross, screenwriter Buck Henry, and producer Lawrence Terman. Nichols on the Barbara Walters Show, 1966. Paul Simon on the Dick Cavett Show, 1970. Some screen tests, including Hoffman and Ross and some others. A long trailer. And they ported forward two commentaries. So one, I believe, was new for the Blu-ray release. This is Mike Nichols and Steven Soderbergh, 2007. And they did bring forward the Howard Suber commentary, 1987. He is a film scholar and provides a visual and thematic analysis of The Graduate. So, Tim, supplements, what did you think? This is it's great to hear, you know, this is really your first time delving into something like this. I'm very curious what you thought.
It really is. You know, like I said before, I'm not one to go into a lot of supplements or any at all. You know, I remember when DVDs first started getting popular back in 99, 2000, and you know, a lot of the earlier DVDs used to have all these extra features, you know, probably not Criterion level features, but a lot of extra features that, you know, was a big seller, at least, you know, it's like, oh, this new thing, this new technology has this extra stuff, you know. So, sure. And even then, I wouldn't go into it that much, you know. And nowadays, you get a DVD or a regular Blu-ray, there's barely anything, you know, other than maybe some trailers and a studio driven commentary or 5 or 10 minute documentary, you know, whatever, more just selling the picture or anything. But with something like this, yes, this is something very brand new to me. So, I mean, I was able to get into most of the supplements, not everything. I mean, I only listened to one of the commentaries. That was the one with Nichols and Steven Soderbergh. And that was one huge pleasant surprise for me when I got the Blu-ray. Was I look at the back and I see Steven Soderbergh's name on it, and I'm like, wow, because I'm beginning to develop an unhealthy obsession with Steven Soderbergh. Nice. Because I'm fascinated with his career. I'm fascinated with what he's doing, what he has done and what he's doing. I think he is it's very obvious how much of a student of film he is and how much he likes to incorporate his knowledge into what he does, because he's not just a director anymore. He's a cinematographer essentially nowadays. I mean, he shot. I was fascinated with how he shot and what he did with Magic Mike XXL last year. And so, you know, when it comes to the commentary, I just loved everything about what he was asking Mike Nichols, you know, when it comes to the beginning of the film, when it comes to, you know, rehearsals and the scuba outfit scene, and the when he talks about audio prelapse, whatever the heck that means, you know, and the use of music, and then how, you know, Benjamin is with his with the expression of her shame, and you know, it's just so many things that him and Nichols were able to get into, which I really enjoyed, you know. So I mean, you know, as far as the supplements, I think that's the one thing that really stuck out to me. Yeah, the interview with Hoffman, I think, is pretty good. You know, how he talks about how he tested and how he had this relationship with Hackman and somebody else, Robert Duvall.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and how Hackman, you know, tested for the Mr. Robinson role. So that was pretty interesting to me. I really enjoyed the Buck Henry Lawrence Terman conversation. I think there was a lot to grasp onto there, you know, when it comes to the how Nichols insisted on Panavision, how you know, they chose Mike Nichols from Barefoot in the Park, you know, and the book versus the movie, and how you know, they talk about the middle class and how what it means, a lot of the stuff that we've already talked about too. I like the settings. The two interviews, one with Dick Cavett and the other one with Barbara Walters, how it really gets you into that setting of that era. So it's really a great slice of that time. And those are moments that I really, really enjoy. I have here smoking exclamation mark because
a lot of smoking.
There's tons of smoking. Yeah. And I really enjoy the, just the conversations that they had. And also, I kind of wish that Barbara Walters would, when she cuts to commercial, I wish that they would have shown a period commercial of that time. But other than that, no, everything is great. The trailer runs for 3 minutes and 45 seconds. Holy
so
cow. Holy cow.
So long.
It shows so much. So obviously there was a lot to dig into, and I liked a lot of it.
So are you sold on supplements now, Tim? Are you going to delve into them?
I don't know about that. maybe only with movies that I really hold in such high regard.
And so why don't you give your Criterion rating, since you talked about the supplements. We give a, you know, scale a 1 to 10. What would you give it?
Anything with Steven Soderbergh gets a 10 for me, so I'll give it a 10.
Nice. There you go.
Yeah, if you Aaron. Didn't give it a 10 after that, I would be disappointed.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just be brief because I think you guys have both covered both of them very well. I'll just say that you know, a lot of times when a movie that's been released on Blu-ray already comes to Criterion, sometimes there's a little bit of hate from the community. Maybe hate's not the right word, but a little bit of like, oh,
a little backlash, or
a little bit. They'll say, well, why don't you put out something that hasn't been there before? But I think Criterion usually steps up and makes the package worthwhile, and I think that's what happened here. I think the supplements are very comprehensive. You know, two commentaries. You know, all these documentaries. So I think that they, even though I don't love the film as much as you guys, I think that the package it is. It actually benefits the film or enhances the film, and it really gives context to everything and the time period that it was made. So I'd say the Criterion rating would be 9.5 for me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm going to go 9.5 too. Tim, I would highly recommend checking out the Howard Suber commentary when you do get a chance. It's well worth your time. That was my favorite supplement by far. I'd heard great things about it, and it did not disappoint. It's just there's so much insight with that one, just about the influences and the filmmaking. It's incredible how much information is in there. I took so many notes that I'd probably come back to at some point. And I'll just mention spoiler alert for folks, that's not Anne Bancroft in the film. That's a body double for the flash cut there. So
yeah,
just letting you know.
I didn't want to know that. I'm kidding.
Suber mentions that it was he puts in, you know, his whole the commentary. You could almost say it's dry, but he puts in some moments of humor. It just goes along so nicely. It's a really nice piece.
I really did like the screen tests, how you see the three different screen tests. The first one between Tony Bill and Jennifer Leake, bad acting, really bad acting. The second one between Robert Lipton and Kathy Carpenter, whisper acting. And then the third one, immediate chemistry between the two, two of them. Aaron, I got to disagree with you about Catherine Ross. I love her in this film. Not only is she one of the three most beautiful people I've ever seen on screen, between her, Claudette Colbert, and Ava Green, I think she is a powerhouse in this film. I think she's strong, fantastic.
I do too. And we referenced the one scene with the where she kind of turns on a dime and shows some emotion. She's very strong. I just meant, you know, she was playing more of herself. I think she actually didn't have as much opportunity as Hoffman and Bancroft, just because, you know, actually she really comes into the picture in the second half.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very,
fair.
Very fair. Yep. Well, I would give it a 9.5 for Criterion rating. I mean, I would have loved for a Spine 800, a movie like this, a Digipak, would have been great. And there is a little bit of overlap in the supplements, but, you know, that's going to happen, I think. But yeah, overall, 9.5, just a beautiful release. And so, Aaron, the big question, are we going to canonize this thing?
No. Sorry.
Yeah, I think we have to have, you know, consensus to canonize it, because I would, but, you know, I understand you can't go there.
Well, you know, I think you guys probably would vote yes. I know Tim would vote yes. And we did, there wasn't consensus for Slacker. So if you guys want to put it in the canon, we can.
Hey, it's your show.
I'll leave it up to Mark.
No, I think we'd have to agree on it, Aaron. You know, and I'd canonize it, but I do have some of the issues with the film that you do. So, you know, if you don't feel it should, then it doesn't deserve to be there. So,
all right.
Not going in the canon.
All right, Benjamin, you're too easy.
No, this film tried to seduce us, but just didn't quite make it.
Yeah, it's pretty close. So,
yep. Well, that is Criterion Close-Up, The Graduate, from Mike Nichols. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
again,
Tim.
As I mentioned before, great to have you on. It's been a great time. You know, brought me up from just the little baby podcaster that I was to what we're doing now. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. It was an honor, really. Like I said, it was totally out of my league, but it's definitely an honor to be with you too.
You were great. More than held up. You did great. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really incredible. So where can folks find you and first-time watchers online?
Oh, where can't you find us? Firsttimewatchers.blogspot.com is all of our back catalog. You can find us on iTunes. You know, our feed is there constantly. You can find us on Twitter at 1STTimeWatchers. We're always interacting with people. We love to interact with people about movies. Firsttimewatchers.tumblr.com. So, yeah, bunch of places.
Is there a First Time Watchers on Facebook?
Yes, absolutely. First Time Watchers, just search First Time Watchers on Facebook and you'll see us right there.
Cool.
Excellent. Definitely follow First Time Watchers. They're a fun listen. Listen to their show. Check them out. You won't be disappointed. You can find Criterion Close-Up online at CriterionCU on Twitter, Facebook/CriterionCloseUp, and you can find us at CriterionCloseUp.com. And Aaron, we can find you on the Twitter sphere.
Yes, AWest505, and I just checked, and I like First Time Watchers on Facebook, so there you go.
Nice.
I forgot.
Nice. And I'm Mark Herney. You can find me online. It's H-U-R-N-E is my last name on Twitter, at Mark Herney. And thank you, folks, for listening. Definitely share the show. We need some more iTunes reviews. It's been over a month since we had a review, so please send us a review. We want to know what you think of the show. Give us a star rating. It helps us reach other listeners. Our next episode will be a Criterion Close-Up episode. I'm not sure how much more we want to talk about that, one of our interviews.
I think we can say it's about art again.
All right.
About cool. Criterion art.
So Criterion Close-Up on art. So we are going to, we let in with The Sound of Silence, and we're going to let it end us. So we'll talk to you next time. Echo the wind of silence, and the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. Sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming.
the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispered the sounds of silence.